program that provides you with content related to queer communities in Colorado. I'm your host, Elise Matital, and I'm speaking with Stevie Gunter, a Black queer archival librarian with Denver Public Library's Blair Caldwell Research Branch.
My name is Stevie Gunter. To put it simply, I use all pronouns. To put it complicated, I'm not to be perceived except at one's own risk, because I feel that my gender is an event horizon. It's a tearing apart of things. And I feel I'm only here by way of my ancestors, you know, and their will. So I feel my pronouns are a verb, a command to be. I think if there's any confusion or hesitation around that, you know, my name will bear the burden. So, you know, people just call me Stevie. And my role in the community, I'm a cultural worker. I am an archivist. I love storytelling. I love to listen deeply and be embodied in listening. I create music as well in a series of projects, both personal and with other people as well. And yeah, I appreciate art and adornment of the body as well. And that's something that I've been exploring a lot in the past year via tattoos and things like that.
Could you maybe say a little bit about what an archivist does? Because I think personally, I have this vague idea, but when I think about what would the day-to-day look like, I have questions about that.
Yeah, I would say in general, an archivist is one who documents, describes, and preserves objects for posterity. And what that's looked like throughout the course of my career so far is working on specific collections. So most of the time, it'll be people's papers or financial documents, correspondence, a lot of ephemera, so like flyers and just fun things like that. And, you know, organizing them into folders, labeling the folders so that researchers could find them. And it's sort of this tricky balance between, like, understanding your positionality and, you know, what you're holding and the subject and the meaning of it as well, and trying to describe that in a way that's not going to give away too much. So when a researcher sees the description or the metadata of this object, they will feel enticed to look through it, you know, and either touch the object or engage with it digitally and really understand more about the work for themselves, right? And sometimes I find that to be a little problematic because I don't prioritize objectivity. I don't believe it exists. And I do the best that I can to describe things as I see them and make it known that who I am as a Black queer person in seeing this object matters. And that's why people should engage with the archives, you know, to uncover the cultural memory and significance of it for them on that particular day, you know, as well as to uplift these things that I do have to, in a very, like, I have to dive deeply into each of these collections, especially here at Blair Caldwell, to digitize them. And there are a lot of things that could be considered not as central to the narrative of what the whole collection represents, but still essential, you know, in their own right. So yeah, I think archivists, in my imagination, an archivist's job is to stoke the imagination of researchers as best as they can.
That's so interesting. And I think about sort of this function that you're describing where you are naming things enough to bring people in, but there's also sort of a gatekeeping function of deciding what is important. You talked about, like, how do you choose which items? Does everything get archived? Maybe you could explain that process a little bit.
Yeah, well, at a previous position that I had at the University of Denver, there were a lot of documents that I would have to shred by the end of the day. And I often joke that one of my favorite things to do as an archivist is throw stuff away. So there are some things like newspaper articles where, you know, Rocky Mountain News, they have their archive of things. So we don't necessarily have to hold on to those. And that has a lot to do with the sort of directives and the desire of the archives themselves. There's priorities for collecting, right? And then on the other hand, there's a lot of personal information. I can't tell you how many like Xeroxes of people's financial information and tax information that I've had to 10 years down the line, you know, get rid of. And then, yes, of course, there's the matter of like, in my work, I've not yet come across this, but I've done a lot of research into it about items that existed prior to the internet and the intention of those items. So, for example, queer and like sexually explicit materials in zines from the 90s. People had no idea how far the internet could proliferate things back then, nor did they, you know, they probably, it's not on us to assume that they are static in those identities as well. And so there are just some things that you have to approach with that sense of like, you know, the subject has the right to refuse to be documented or to be archived. And the subject has a right to change what the archive is actually telling, right? So I think in all these senses, there's no linearity and there's no staticness to archives as much as the profession probably wants there to be.
That's so interesting, thinking about just like queer temporality and that like your identity changes over time, that like to identify as queer in a certain context can change. So you mentioned that your identities as Black and queer influence how you archive things, or your process or approach to this. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I feel as a Black person, I know I love storytelling. I love oral histories. That really speaks to me on a deep spiritual basis, right? And so oftentimes when I'm working and I see these handwritten letters that, for example, an archive I'm working on right now is Marie Greenwood's papers. She was one of the first, she was the first Black teacher in Denver public schools, and she desegregated the system, a really amazing person. But she has a lot of handwritten letters. And sometimes I think, especially coming up in her day, how writing is seen as essential. And that's not always been the case for our people. And for like descendants of enslaved people, there's this fraught history of literacy. People would be brutalized for learning how to read and teaching others to read. Meanwhile, Marie Greenwood is, you know, such a prominent cultural figure because she hosted these read aloud programs teaching youth how to read. That was her thing, you know? So a lot of the times it's just coming, it's understanding where the tensions lie between the master's tools and trying to dismantle the master's house, as Audre Lorde is trying to get us to think about all the time. So I think about that a lot, especially in terms of my Blackness. And yeah, in terms of like being Black and queer together, sometimes I feel, what is the point of doing memory work in the first place? Being in a human body, we can't hold on to things forever. And being a child of the information age, I often wonder, do we even need to, you know? How many of our archives are on Facebook just completely, you know, out there, and we never really return to with a critical eye. And I sometimes think the power of forgetting is so important as well, that I think it's really fun to sort of challenge that in my work all the time. What am I sharing and why? Who is going to use this? And what is the actual reuse potential over time? What will my work mean 10, 20 years from now, especially in terms of environmental impact as well, because storage, you know, that leaves a footprint. And we do have to back things up in several places as well. And yeah, working at an institution like Denver Public Library, it's a white institution predominantly. And even though I work at a Black branch, my department is in the central library, and I am one of a handful of Black people on that team. I often wonder, what is the drive for getting this work done? Is it to actually uplift our narratives, which I do believe. I think it's a mixture of that, as well as like archives inherently are exploitative, and that's the history of the profession, the root of the profession.
You're naming such a tension, and I'm thinking about even just, so the Blair Caldwell branch was named by Mayor Wellington Webb, the first Black mayor, and named after two prominent Black figures in Denver. But does naming something just allow you to then be like, great, we did it. Now we don't have to do anything else with the rest of Denver Public Library or Denver?
Right.
That's such a tension.
Right. And recently it's been called into question, I think the Byers branch is being renamed because the person after which it was named was involved in the Sand Creek Massacre. And I do think a name is important, you know, it's very symbolic, but I do think symbols have to represent things in our physical realities as well. And so I think a large part of that is finding the meaning of the work and engaging that in conversation, you know, with colleagues and everything.
I mean, it sounds like you're really talking about memorialization of certain people and places. And I'm thinking about your work just in the context of Denver, and that specific branch, which is located in Five Points in the historically Black neighborhood in Denver. How do you think about like the place aspect of your work?
I constantly think of the land as an archive. I pull a lot of that knowledge from transnational feminism and indigenous feminisms. And that's really important to me, especially here. I myself am not from Denver, you know, but I do feel being here, it's my duty, not only through the work that I do, but just being physically in Five Points on stolen Ute and Arapaho lands to uplift as much as I can the histories that we are building on top of, you know, and to understand that in the landscape of the archives, it doesn't look just like papers in folders and boxes. It does look like how dust collects on the demolition of buildings. And it looks like who's picking up their dog's poop outside of foreclosed homes, you know. That's an integral part of the story. And I think the fact that this branch was created, I believe in 2003, like the construction was finished in that year, the gentrification of Five Points was already well underway. But I do think that having this building here physically, in its aesthetic as well, the facade of this building is beautiful. I think it's important sometimes to disrupt that space and to remind us that, you know, history is not, can't totally be erased, and that something was here before and continues to as well. It's a futurism and it's a visioning still too.
That was perfectly leads into my next question. So much of your work is looking back at the past, but it sounds like you're also squarely rooted in futurism and looking at the future and like different possibilities. How do you hold that?
I think on a spiritual basis, I want to uplift the concept of Sankofa, which is reaching into the past to bring forward, you know, into the future. And I think being an archivist, I get to live my Afrofuturist fantasy in that all the time. So I mentioned Marie Greenwood, and there's another person whose archives I really want to uplift, being Rachel Knoll here. And she really fought hard for desegregation of schools as well, and was one of the primary figures in busing for desegregation as well. And I think as we talk about gentrification, it's not a new conversation. It would be strange to assume that it would be brand new to us. But when we can return to the archives in a central zone of gentrification in this city, we can understand more how this is an ongoing fight and how the legacy of gentrification has always been here. If we look down the street to the Auraria campus, that is a huge example of Denver's urban renewal program and how that's displaced a lot of like our Latinx siblings, you know? So I think by looking back into the archives, we understand ourselves as just a part of this greater legacy, right, of resistance and of survival, as well as of trauma, and that we were never alone in this fight. And I think the last important point on that I want to make is there are people who have done a lot of hard work before us. And I think the hardest thing about organizing sometimes is not understanding that there is a blueprint and that all the failures that have led us to this moment can be composted into something new, right? There are constantly lessons that we could take from the past. And I definitely want to uplift that in the work that I do.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Outsources on KGNU Boulder, Denver. I'm your host, Elise Matatal, and I'm speaking with Stevie Gunter, an archival librarian with Denver Public Library. You know, that makes me think about your personal history. You didn't, like, come fully formed to Denver.
Yeah.
I'm curious about your upbringing, your path even to, like, library sciences and archive work. How did you get interested in that, and where did you come from?
Well, I came from the Southeast, namely North Carolina and Georgia. That's where I spent most of my formative years, and a little bit of time in Texas too. And I think just being from so recently from the South, you know, has taught me a lot about holding on to histories that are just so painful and things that are so essential to who you are, right? Bringing it closer to me as an individual, I'm a military child. Both my parents were, and in our families, that was a huge thing, right? That was something that really was a pathway for us, for generations. And as a transnational feminist, I am always thinking about the ways that imperialism and white supremacy permeates our daily lives, and capitalism too. And so, in an effort to be more critical of my own histories, you know, and even down to how I got my last name, throughout college, I was just always interested in ancestry, right? And reckoning with the cost of the ongoing costs of enslavement. And so I took this class with one of my mentors who now lives and teaches here. And it was this capstone for a women's and gender studies class. And it was called Transnational Feminisms. And I chose to do this topic about Afro-German women. And at the time I was studying sociology, and I had just returned from studying abroad in Gießen. And my priority for that project was to get as many cultural works as I could and present them, you know, at the symposium. And so leaning heavily on the work of Audre Lorde, who went to Berlin, you know, primarily for cancer treatment, but also to help raise consciousness of Afro-German women. And also leaning on the work of May Ayim, one of the benefactors of Audre Lorde's work there. I was running into a lot of hurdles. I was like, I can't find any research. I can't really reach out to anybody. I'm on such a short, like, timeline. How do I get these primary sources? So I went to Klein Library, which is at the University of Northern Arizona, or Northern Arizona University, rather. And I tapped in. I was like, my librarian friends, like, what can I do? And another one of my mentors, who actually really helped me find the path to, like, archives, was like, do you know that archives exist? And did you know that we can get you anything from anywhere in the world, like, with just a scan, just an interlibrary loan? And it seemed so magical to me, just having information at your fingertips in a way that I didn't realize before. So it was because of that project and because of who I am, I guess, and my yearnings in life that I was like, I guess I just want to be an archivist. I don't want to make research. I want to help people do effective research.
Wow, that's so interesting. I just think about, like, what I know about transnational feminism is really about knowledge production and these sites of knowledge production. And you're really speaking to how things can be withheld, like access to resources, access to knowledge, access to the archives. And so opening that up and like really creating a different radical process around it sounds life-changing.
Totally.
Wow. I have so many thoughts. Well, shifting gears a little bit, I am curious about your band. It's called Two Lips. Did I pronounce that right?
Two Lips.
Two Lips. Okay. If you want to speak to the band, and I guess I'm curious what instruments you play and how you got involved in the band.
Yeah. So it started because Meow Wolf came here. And it was around the tail end of my first summer here. I met the drummer of Two Lips in its iteration back then. We rode on this roller coaster, and I was like, wow, this is meant to be. You know, like our very first meeting, something so incredible and fun, it seemed like that would foretell the energy of the group. I wasn't invited just yet, you know, but that was definitely the beginning, the beginning of like, we're fun people. Let's have fun making art together. But the band actually began, I think, 2 years before me. And it's a collective. So people have come and gone throughout time. And again, the intention was always a space to come as is and just create music together and have fun. That's the short of it. I think the band to me, with it being a collective, has taught me so much about community building and what it means to share a vision and to move towards a vision together, cohesively, with trust and with transparency. And I think that's a huge, unique aspect of us, especially in relation to other groups that I've either been in or witnessed here in Denver. And I just really hope that the vision of Two Lips is cultivated beyond Two Lips as well.
Yeah, and I just want to name from the band's, I think, website or Twitter, I just pulled the description of it. It's a band colectivo of feminista, genre nonconforming, by QT Pac, disrupting the local Denver music scene. So I guess I'm curious about the genre nonconforming aspect and how y'all are disrupting the local Denver music scene. If you can even put it into words, that might be hard to name.
Yeah, I think that is the part about it, is oftentimes when we're invited to play or describe ourselves, it's so difficult because we're three different people. Currently, we're three different people coming together to create something in a moment that we all feel like represents us. So each song, I feel like in terms of what we're trying to get at, whether it's heartbreak because of the work that we're doing or heartbreak because of relationships in other ways, it's these threads connect, you know, all of our work, but the sound of it is so inspired by a bunch of different things that it's kind of hard to box ourselves in. And we also don't want to do that, you know. I think that's the incredible part about being genre nonconforming, is introducing that confusion and just being like, I guess you'll just have to have us. And I guess we'll have to play with any and everyone if you want us to play. And I think there was another aspect of the question that you're asking I might have missed.
Just like generally disrupting the Denver music scene, which I know can be like really male and really white in Denver.
Yeah, totally, totally. It's been a challenge in a lot of ways because we've had to really rely on a DIY aesthetic of, if we want to put a show together, we're going to have to do it ourselves because we don't necessarily want to be playing with people who we feel aren't aligned with, you know? And so we feel like it disrupts the scene because we are coming up, you know, and I'd say there are a good amount of people who know us, want to play with us, but it's kind of hard to fit into the expectations of what that'll mean. One of our members, Celeste Martinez, does work with this group called Colorful Colorado Collaborations. And oftentimes, when she's organizing shows with them, it's understanding the dynamics of other bands and presenting to them, the alternate vision of like, this is what Tulips looks like. And that sort of disrupts, I believe it disrupts in a moment how bands can perceive themselves even. What does it look like to be in a band? What does it mean to leave bands as well? And how do we fit a collective into a bill with, more traditional bands or whatever that means, So it's a constant questioning and reflection that I think we offer whenever we go out to perform.
Well, in our next, like, or last minute or so, I guess I'm curious about, like, what you're working on. Like, what are these next projects that you're excited about? I think I might have heard that you are involved in abolition work in Denver. So I don't know if you can speak to that as well.
Yeah, as far as abolition work, that's just my ethos. I feel nothing should be done without abolition as a core value, right? And I think a part of that involves like my work, for example, tying it to my work. I'm currently working on digitizing 14 of the most frequently used collections at Blair Caldwell. And the next phases of my project will include building an exhibit, digital exhibit around some of these collections and developing teaching kits with educators locally, right? And when it comes to abolition work, not only is it taking the lessons of literally like we should divest from certain suppliers to our archives because they rely on prison labor, but also what is the work we're doing here in describing people's lives and how do we divest from hard fixed categories as well. I think a lot of times in abolition, that's what we're trying to vision beyond is the categorization of people and thus ways to punish them, either by excluding them from histories or the like, right? And I feel like my positionality at this branch specifically, because we service a lot of unsheltered folks, is developing a praxis of compassion as well. We here, we call STAR first, always, and not the police whenever there's a crisis, And I think not only continuing to do that work, but just seeking alternative routes for ensuring that we can create a safe and equitable space for people, especially in the hot summer months and the cold winter months as well, is important. The space and what we offer as a library is so important that we need to make sure that we're interrogating the practices that we're using to sustain that space,
You've been listening to Outsources on KGNU Boulder, Denver. I'm Elise Madatal, and I've been speaking with Stevie Gunter, musician and archivist in Denver. For more information about Stevie, you can visit news.kgnu.org and click on Outsources under the Shows and Features tab. As always, let us know if you have comments or feedback about today's show by emailing outsources@kgnu.org. Join us next week, Monday, at 6:30 p.m. for another episode of Outsources, providing you homegrown queer radio every week. That's Monday, 6:30 p.m. right here on KGNU, or listen anytime after the broadcast at kgnu.org/outsources.